endorsing the event, and for Saturday morning for pulling this together, and the committee for asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope via my story today. I want to thank also the people who put together our workshops today, Linda, Lydia, and Judy. I took a lot of notes, so I'm very grateful that you guys put your program together today. And thank Mike for coming from Massachusetts, for parking your car at the airport and coming on down. I guess I should start with how I got in or when I got into the program. I came in July of 2002. I do have a home group, and it is this Saturday Sunrise group. So in full disclosure, I am biased and think that I have the best home group out there. But I did believe that before they asked me to speak today. I heard recently a description that there's a difference between a group and a meeting. And that a group comes together to do service and to come together with each other between meetings. A meeting is a place where we go and hear and share about Al-Anon. Saturday Sunrise is a group. If you have a great group, I'd love to attend it. Please chat me on it. I'd love to see some other great groups. Also, I do have a sponsor. I do sponsor others. We meet once a week. That's the way my sponsor does it. That's the way his sponsor does it. So that's the way we do it. And I go to 3 to 5 meetings a week. Now, if you're a newcomer, welcome. If this is your first exposure to Al-Anon and you're hearing that somebody with this many years in is still meeting 3 to 5 times a week, they must be pretty sick. And trust me, your instincts are correct. That is why I meet 3 to 5 times a week. I'm trying to overcome a lifelong set of habits that weren't serving me very well. So what we always say to newcomers is try 6 meetings, try different meetings, keep an open mind, and keep coming back. So I think it's interesting for me that actually I attend more meetings now than I did when I first came into Al-Anon. And I wondered about that, why that is, and I'll get into that a little bit later. But I think it's because I was afraid of change. I thought change was a negative. I thought it would take away from me and somehow I would lose part of me if I changed. And I didn't want to let that go. But what I found through the groups and through the literature is that change is another word for improvement. So I'm trying to become the best person I can be, and I make mistakes, and I do well, and I keep coming back because there's a lot of nuance to this program. It's not just straightforward. It's not. I thought I read the steps and I understood them and went on, and I find that there's a lot of work that went into creating the words of the steps and the traditions and the concepts and the principles. The words are important. You know, in this particular meeting, it's a meeting about resiliency through the steps and the serenity prayer. And I thought I knew what that meant. I thought I know what a lot of words mean. For me, I used to have a catchword, a go-to, and that was persistence. And I thought, well, resiliency is kind of like persistence, and I always thought that persistence was a good deal. I had a thing that was in my father's office, and it was on the wall, and it was not a very philosophical guy, and so this kind of stood out to me. And it was a quote from Calvin Coolidge, who was, I think, the 30th president of the U.S. Not one of your shining stars, I don't think, but kind of an average guy who I think he succeeded Warren Harding. And then was reelected, and he was the president during the Great Depression. So just prior to the Great Depression. So you think that, well, you know, what has he got to share? But what was going on there was he was an average guy, and he became president of the United States. Well, he knew something. So this quote to him stuck with me pretty hard, and it was about persistence. And it was, nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not, Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. The slogan, "Press on," has solved and always will solve the problems of the human race. So I thought, well, heck, I could do that. In fact, I got so good at it that in my family of origin, I became the most persistent. Now, they said I was the most stubborn, right? But they were being pejorative. I was persistent. And so I thought that was an asset. In fact, when I did my first four-step inventory, my sponsor will tell you that I put it on the asset side of my inventory. But like many ideas and words in Al-Anon, it's not as they seem. So like our speakers before us today, I had to go look up the word resilient, and I wanted to compare it to persistent. And I didn't go to a psychological thing like Linda did. She's a lot smarter than I can. I couldn't even read that book. But I went to Wikidiff, which is my version of an encyclopedia. And it said that persistent is obstinately refusing to give up or let go. And resilient is able to endure tribulation without cracking. Well, in that comparison, persistent isn't all that nice. It's kind of like stubborn. But anyway, I was good at it. Still am, actually. To go back on my family of origin, both my parents drank. They both drank alcoholically. Their social life was the local tavern. We had no family friends. They had bar friends, which of course didn't include the children. I have no memories of ever going on a vacation, but we do have one photo in some family collection somewhere where I'm standing and holding some fish. So we must have had at least one vacation, although I don't think I ever went fishing after that. But it was a home. I had four children in the home, three siblings, a brother and two sisters. And I'm not going to go into that life of what the alcoholism there was like. I think we all know what that environment is like. You know, it's the drama, it's the illogical and unspoken changing rules, and the loneliness. And for children, it was a strange normal. Sometimes fearful, sometimes free and untethered. But never like the families down the block or the ones on television. It just wasn't like that. Growing up in that home, I developed coping mechanisms, as we all do, to deal with life as we grow up. And one of them was denial. It took the form of, no, it's not that bad. Stop crying. It's not that bad. There's nothing to see here. Or whiskey in your coffee in the morning is normal. Developed a coping mechanism of self-reliance. You know, I heard 1,000 times, if you want something done right, you have to do it yourself. Or if you're hungry, go make yourself something to eat. This is to 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. And in fact, the children had to make dinner for the parents. The parents would go to the tavern after work, and they would come home at 9 or 10 o'clock and expect the house to be clean and dinner to be made. I also was repeatedly told that I was no good and never would be, so I had low self-esteem, and I definitely learned there is but one authority, period. So I had resentment of authority. Now, in fairness to them, my parents grew up in the Depression, a very, very difficult time. They had to work in order to feed the family, for the family to get by. My mother was orphaned very young. Her mother had died, and her father was a untreated alcoholic. And there were, I think, 7 children. He could not take care of them, so he took them all to the orphanage and left them there, and he took off on his drinking career. All of her siblings, my mother's siblings, were adopted, but my mother was not. She was too persistent. and she would get moved from one foster home to another. I doubt in her life if she ever heard, or at least as a child, she ever heard the words, "I love you." I know that I do not recall us ever using the words, "I love you," in our home. I do recall it being on television, but it was not something that we did. We did not have that kind of a family. But I mean, honestly, things were not always dark. Looking back on my childhood, you know, there were many things that I learned. I learned how to be resourceful. I learned how to be dependable. I learned how to be industrious, and I learned how to speak truth to authority. Our parents owned their own business. It was open 7 days a week. The two boys in the family were required to work there, and my older sister had to take care of our baby sister. Now, I learned that when our parents came home inebriated and angry, or sometimes just inebriated and happy, it could be that too, you didn't know, right, what you're going to get. But when they came home angry, I used to memorize plays and jokes and comedians on TV, and then I would give them that performance when they came home, and or singing a song or doing something to get them to change their mood. I really thought as a child I could change other people. I could change people's mood. This is another delusion that I take into adulthood. But as a child, I didn't understand that all I was doing was distracting them. I just didn't understand that. I thought I had that kind of power. So that may be where some of my control issues come from. I do remember in grade school, I volunteered to become a patrol boy. Some of you may not know what that is. Patrol boy was a crossing guard at the time, and we got to wear a little bandana, a little belt, and we could wear that, and we would go to the intersections of the school, and we held the children back so cars could pass, right? And nowadays, of course, you have crossing guards that hold up the cars so the children could pass, but we did it backwards. The chicken gets to the other side of the road either way, but what was good about this was I was in control of the children. I like that. That was good. I got to wear my little belt when I was inside. I got to be a hall monitor, and at recess, I could stitch on kids. So that I was really in a control mood, and so my life was set. I had figured it out. I was going to be self-reliant, persistent, and in control. I was a real little jerk. The good news is I grew up to be a big jerk. After finishing school, I went into, spent some time in the service. There I became convinced that there was but one authority, period. And I also found out it was better to be the authority. And I was promoted for my efforts in the military. I got early promotions. And so this was the first time an authority figure had recognized me. It fed my ego. I felt appreciated. It felt good. I wanted more. So these are the skills I take into adulthood. I met a wonderful woman, married her, love at first sight. I left my family of origin in the dust, and we moved quite a bit. Several of our people today talked about a lot of moves. We did that as well. We moved around a bit, Illinois, Indiana, Arizona, California. And as we were first married, we partied for 4 years before deciding to have a family. Of course, deciding to have a family is the easy part, and having a family is the hard part. After the first child, of course, things changed. Mom was busy raising our son, and Dad had no longer the focus of Mom's attention. I developed something that I would later learn that you call a resentment. I didn't know what that word was. I told myself that I needed to provide for my family, so I succeeded at work through my persistence. I was not the smartest employee, but I could outwork everyone and would outwork everyone, just like I had growing up. I was not the biggest or smartest in the family, but I could outlast you. I could wear you out. I would just burn you out. Anyway, I told myself I needed to do that at work because we had agreed, my wife and I had agreed that after having children, she'd go back to work, but that didn't happen. So I developed a second resentment. Again, not knowing what that was, but I had something that was going on in the back of my head. I put my energy in the work, and I got promotions there for my effort. and I felt appreciated and it felt good. Now, I was that kind of boss, though, that you hated. The boss that didn't care if you had to take the children to school or they were sick or anything else. I just need to get the job done. You agree to do the job, now do it. So I had found, of course, an organization that would reward that, and so I got rewarded for work, and working 7 days a week was no big deal for me. I grew up doing that. So now, my wife wasn't very much in favor of that, and so Dad was no longer the center of Mom's attention. Dad was getting approval at work and promotions. Mom was tired. Mom was taking care of children. Our sex life dwindled. Now, that was a problem for me. And what do I do with problems? No, I don't seek help. I solve them myself. So I went outside of our marriage to fix my problem. Now, that didn't work for me, and I quit that. But I had neglected to even involve my wife in the conversation. Three more promotions in 3 years, I become a hotshot. I'm thinking in the back of my mind, hey, Dad, what do you think now, Dad? You know, I found out in doing this four-step inventory that all along, all I'm trying to do is get approval. That's all I'm trying to do is get approval and love. And I will go wherever it takes to get approval and love. But now, more responsibility, longer hours, traveling. I'd get on a plane on Sunday night or Monday morning, be gone till Friday. My wife is taking care of children at home. We'd fight on the phone all week long, and then I'd come home on the weekend and we'd fight in person. Get on a plane Sunday night again. I couldn't wait to get on the plane again Sunday night to get out. So more moves, more jobs, thinking each one was a fresh start. But of course, we were taking the baggage with us. We tried marriage counseling and a separation, and we were able to get back together. We're now back in California after about 26 years into this marriage, and it did not look like it was going to make 27. Another try with a counselor. Well, I don't know if it was the third or fourth time, but anyway, it's my time to try and pick a counselor. Now, how do you pick a marriage counselor? I mean, do you go to your neighbor? No. We didn't have a priest or a counselor like that. Our family was out of town. They wouldn't know anyone anyway. So, my problem, I'll fix it. I picked up the phone book. Now, for those of you who are too young to know what a phone book was, phone books are what we used before they had booster chairs. Now, in the phone book, there was a section on marriage and family counseling. So I'm doing this in a fit of anger. I did have anger. I do know how to do anger. And so I run my finger down the line, and I stop right in the middle of the column. I said, okay, that's our marriage counselor. Now, I was going into marriage counseling for one reason and one reason only, to get the marriage counselor to agree that my wife needed to change. That was why I was going. And this one looked as good as any other. So we do that, and I'm thinking, boy, what a good boy am I. You know, I'm participating here. Well, after a questionnaire and a few visits, the counselor identifies alcohol as a problem for us individually and for us growing up in alcoholic home. She had grown up in an alcoholic home as well. So the counselor said we need to stop alcohol use and go to AA meetings. So I said, okay, and started doing it. My wife said, I don't think that's a very good idea. I didn't understand what she was doing, but I was going to my AA meetings, and she was or wasn't going. She wouldn't go to the same meetings I went to. But she had not stopped drinking. She was still doing her thing. And I could never figure it out. You know, I didn't know that she was alcoholic. Honestly, I never knew this. I knew that she didn't do what I wanted her to do. I knew that. And she would get mad when I told her to do something. I knew that. But I didn't understand that there was alcoholism involved here. I mean, we drank. I drank. She drank. We both drank wine. And honest to God, I never saw more than one glass of wine on the kitchen counter. Never. And it would get down to maybe halfway and then all the way down. That was it. But she was drunk. It would come out later on when she tells her story. she had the box of wine in the pantry. And so when she's making dinner, she's going in there and refilling it. I didn't know. I'm watching television. I'm an idiot, not seeing what's going on. But she had a problem. I continue going to the counselor as an individual, and so does she. And the counselor says, "Well, how are those AA meetings going?" And I said, "You know, they seem like they're pretty good. You know, they have coffee, they give you cookies, they seem like nice people. You know, but I don't get it. You know, they have such a hard time with this quitting drinking. You know, I can't wait till they ask me to get up there and share, and I can tell them, all you do is don't pick it up. It's not that big of a deal." So the counselor, to her credit, did not laugh. She instead said, "I think I know just a meeting for you. It's called Al-Anon." I said, "What's an Al-Anon?" She said, "Oh, don't worry about it. Just go." She said, "And go to 3 meetings a week." So right away, I'm thinking, 3 meetings a week? Are you kidding me? Once a week at best. That's it. That's all I'm going to do. So I'm going to my first 3 meetings. And in my first 3 meetings, I get virtually nothing out of those first 3 meetings. But the meeting with the counselor is coming up, and I need to be able to tell her something. So on my fourth meeting that week, I decided to go into the room, not just sit outside in the car, feeling too afraid to be judged and criticized by a bunch of strangers. I was scared to death to go into the room. I had no idea. I'd never done anything like this, and I was not going in. But I had this thing, right? I had to tell the counselor something. So I went in. So I go in, I sit down next to a guy in there. Of course, I get in just before the start of the meeting, right? I don't want to talk to anybody. I get in just before the start of the meeting, and I say, "What is this deal with Al-Anon?" He says, "Well, it's kind of like AA. We use the same steps as AA. And they only change one word. And, you know, we kind of work the steps. Well, the bell's ringing, and we got to start the meeting." So he said, "We'll stay after the meeting and we'll talk." So they get him to read the steps. Now, I've been going to AA meetings, and I heard the steps, and so I'm expecting to hear the same thing. But I will swear to you to this day that when he read the steps, it came up differently. So the meeting begins, and he reads the steps. Now, I swear this is what he said. He said, "We were powerless over alcohol, and our wives had become unmanageable." And I said, this is the group for me. She's absolutely right. This is exactly where I need to be. Right then and there, I said, I could love this meeting. I remember a couple other things from that meeting. First of all, it was hot. It was July. It was hot. It was in that loft of a church. And I thought, no air conditioning. I thought, well, this is rather ironic. It's as hot as Hades up here. Why would these people be meeting up here? So I took that away. The other thing I took away was, take what you like and leave the rest. Oh, the out clause. I like that. And then keep coming back. Well, okay. They want my money. So now, I know they said more than that, but honestly, it was enough to get me back to another meeting. Of course, I found out later that was not the one word we changed, but it did get me to come back. So I visited some other meetings, and I found a Saturday morning meeting. Now, I did not go there just because it was air-conditioned. But it was air conditioned, and I did appreciate that fact. It was actually convenient. It was Saturday morning. I was working, and after a rough week, I thought Saturday morning would be a great way to decompress. And so I went with that. And later on, I'd come to believe that rather than it was a way to end my week, it was a great way to start my week. The meeting was 25 women and one man. I was the other guy. So I go in and I'm talking to him. Well, he's leaving town. So it's me and 25 women. Now, I have some problem with women. I don't trust women. So here I sit for about 5 years, by the way, as the only guy in the room. Now, for the first 6 months, I don't think I opened my mouth. I didn't know what to tell you. I certainly wasn't going to talk about me, and I didn't know how to fix your problems. I heard you had all these problems, boy, I could sure help you, but I just don't know. I'll read some more. In the meantime, I'm going to the going to still meet with that counselor, and she says, "Well, do you have a sponsor yet?" I said, I don't need a sponsor. You know, the group meets, we read Path to Recovery, we read the book, we answer the questions. You know, I've answered the questions. In fact, I think I've done steps 1, 2, and 3. I'm pretty well done. I'm starting on step 4. And she said, you need to get a sponsor. You kind of need to do this. You need, so I said, all right. Well, about that time, my wife, who had been going to, I guess, different meetings and seeing this counselor individually, comes in one of my sessions and said she wants some help, that she's decided that she can't drink anymore and she doesn't know how to stop. I had been working with this counselor, and she had been asking me, what do I want? And I couldn't answer the question. I said, I wanted my wife to stop drinking, smoking, wanted to get a job. I want my boss to stop being a jerk. I want my children to be grateful for what we've given them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, no, what do you want? The words I finally came up with was, I wanted to live in a sober home. And I told my wife that before she took a trip to Arizona. And so when she came back, she decided she was going to give it a try. So she went to a rehab, and in that rehab, they have a family night, or a family afternoon, a Sunday afternoon. And so I got a chance to go to that meeting, and it was kind of like a group therapy, but really orientation, and talked about for the first time the disease of alcoholism, which I didn't really know or pay attention to actually that Saturday morning. What I heard there was pretty remarkable, talking about the disease of alcoholism. And I didn't look at it as a disease. I looked at it as a choice. I had quit drinking. What's the big deal here? That was my experience. I wasn't making this up. This is my experience. Here's how you do it. But what they said was alcohol affects relationships. And you have unhealthy relationships with active alcoholism. And it's kind of like, they told me, it's kind of like the letter A. An unhealthy relationship is like the letter A, in that both parties are dependent upon each other. And in a healthy relationship, it's kind of like the letter H, where two healthy people choose to come together. Well, this absolutely described who we were. They also gave me a test on codependency. I think it was 30 questions on codependency. And they said if you answered 3 or more of these, you're probably codependent. I got a 27. I mean, I got an A on this thing. But this idea of the dependency was really hit home for me. And then I began to worry, well, wait a minute. If I get healthy, what's my wife going to do? Is she either going to crash or she's going to stand up? Well, I'm scared to death. If I let go here, right? If I let go, she's going to fail. So I had a real hard time with this concept that you have of letting go. But the message that they gave to the families there, and the message that I got from Al-Anon, is that I need to bring a healthy me to this relationship. That's what I need to do. That's my work. My work is not to fix her, it's to fix me. And if we read on page 60 in Hope for Today, it's that one on A plus B equals C, where A is me and B is the alcoholic and C is the relationship, the third entity. I realized that I could transform A myself and get a different C, whether B, the alcoholic, changed or not. What? Well, that kind of makes sense. Al-Anon says it another way as well. In our closing, it says, you can find contentment and even happiness whether the alcoholic is drinking or not. I came back to that Saturday morning meeting with a new dedication, and I began listening and learning. Now, the first things that hit me were the slogan. And I have many favorite slogans. My favorite slogan of all, they don't even publish it, it's slower traffic, keep right. And in fact, I have a copy of that here. This one I actually got when I ran over it on the highway I was having to pass a slow driver in the left-hand lane. I actually used the emergency lane and hit the sign, but slower traffic. But it's not it's not approved Al-Anon slogan. But there are other things that you taught me. When I had come into the rooms of Al-Anon, I think I looked like this, okay, like a regular person. But in fact, inside, I looked like this. And I didn't know how to get all those pieces of the puzzle back. You look like this. You look like you had it together. So how'd you do that? So what I found out is they said, well, you do need to get a sponsor and you'll need to do that. But there's some other things you need to do. You know, how do you put a puzzle together? Well, you put a puzzle together. The first thing you do, you lay out all the pieces, right? And then you look for these little squares, right? So that you can put those in the corner. So you look at the four corners first. So you put this one in this corner, and another one in that corner. And so you build up these four corners. Okay, the four corners are go to meetings, get a sponsor, and work the program, read the literature every day, and do service. Now, if you do that, you're on your way. They said, when you get your sponsor, what your sponsor is going to do is he's going to help you find all the pieces that have the flat edge on them, right? You got to start with the flat edges, right? You got to start up here. And you're going to work the steps all the way across here. Then you're going to work the traditions. Then you're going to work with the concepts. And then you're going to work with the warranties. Now, after you've done that, you've got a border. In Al-Anon, we call that a boundary. You work in here. She works out there. You don't work her puzzle. You work your puzzle. Just your puzzle. Don't be looking at over her shoulder. Don't be picking at her pieces there. You work on your puzzle's not done. Now, some of the pieces are you know, quite confusing. Sometimes you get a piece that looks like this. It doesn't look like it fits. So you go talk to your sponsor. He says, well, let's look at that from a different perspective. Oh, that's what a sponsor does. Now, I wanted to share something with you because I think sponsorship is a big deal. It is to me. And I've found a sponsor. I had to go to a men's meeting to find a sponsor because I couldn't find a sponsor in the meetings I was going to. They were all women. And I thought about getting a female sponsor, but I was able to find a male meeting and went there. The guy's been terrific. He's been my temporary sponsor for 19 years. This is something that that I wrote because I think it's a sponsorship is a big deal. Sponsorship. You see, things were not always this way, but they are the way they are today. I have regrets for some choices made and resentments for the price I paid. I thought that if I could manage to clean up or fix all the damage, then no one would ever see my fears and vulnerabilities. I feel as if I should have known how to do all this on my own. Because if the tough get going when the going gets tough, then maybe I'm just not tough enough. You said that sponsorship is what I need, someone's help with the Al-Anon creed. Not too sure who I should ask. It seems to be an enormous task. What if you reject me? What if you expect me to speak of feelings that make me queasy? Those conversations will not be easy. It's like asking you to be my friend, but that's not my purpose or end. Just be someone to illuminate a better way, a better fate. Well, I think I'll ask, and then I'll see if you are willing to work with me. Perhaps a coffee or a cup of tea, just conversation, you and me. I am so grateful, so thankful that you said yes. There's no way that I could ever guess that you would respect me, that you would accept me for who I am and what I've done. I feared that you would cut and run, but you said, no, we've just begun. Some days may be sad, some days will be fun. My burden now is much lighter, and my days, they're getting brighter. You were right, sponsorship was what I needed, and grateful, keep coming back, is what I heeded. I can't say enough and thank enough the sponsorship relationship that I have. It's changed my life. It is the first time that I experienced unconditional love. Shortly after I got the sponsor, he needed to have surgery. And so he said, well, you know, he's going to get a ride to the airport. He had to leave his car somewhere. And so I said, I'm the guy. I'll take you to the airport. No problem. He said, you don't need to do that. I got to I'll figure out. I said, no, I'm the guy. See, I want to pay him back, you know? So, I said, all right. You got to be here at 7 o'clock. I got to go over, da, 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 da. So, I oversleep. I mean, I've known this guy for like a month. I had to take him to the hospital, oversleep. So I panic. I get over to his house. He's already gone. So I go over to the hospital, and he's already there. He's laying in bed, and I'm apologizing profusely. I guess I'm doing my first ninth step. You know, I'm just berating myself. You know, God, you know, sorry. He said, it's not a problem. I had other plans. I got here. I'm in bed. I'm in time for my surgery. I'm going to have my surgery. He said, let it go. I had never experienced unconditional love like I have with sponsorship. It's different. It really is different. Well, with sponsorship, of course, and using the tools of the program, my life has had spiritual awakenings. And part of that was I did not need to fix my wife. What I heard from my sponsor for many, many weeks, just like that counselor had been asking me for many, many weeks, can you accept her for who she is? And I had a hell of a time with that. But eventually it did begin to sink in that acceptance, rather than to understanding what makes people tick and trying to fix them, is a better way for me to live. Probably better for her too, but it's definitely better for me. A lot of this wisdom comes, yes, from my sponsor, and yes, from this group. The Saturday Sunrise group is a book study group, and they work the steps, the traditions, and the concepts. That's part of it. A lot of groups don't do that, and I'm very appreciative of this group that does it, because it gives me insights and other things, you know, that more be revealed stuff. So anyway, I'm in the program, and I got I'm starting to work the steps. I had a hell of a time, step one, hell of a time, as you can hear. Step two was kind of worse, because I did not have a relationship with a power greater than myself. I believed in God, but I thought that God, you know, click, big boom theory or big bang theory, and we're done, and you're on your own after that. So I didn't have much faith in that, but they said, you got to keep trying. So I developed a thing. Judy talked about the serenity prayer and how you use that for resilience, and so I thought, all right, well, I'm going to give this a try. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say the serenity prayer every day when I'm tying my shoes. Every day. So I'm not going to forget to do that. So I get into this routine, and I don't know how long I did it. A long time, months. Because I'm trying to make contact with this higher power. And finally, nothing is clicking for me. And so I finally threatened my higher power. I figured, you know, if all else fails, threats work, right? And so I said, look, if we don't come up with something here, if you don't give me some kind of a sign that you're involved here. I mean, how am I going to turn my life over to you if you're not even answering the phone, right? I get busy signals all the time. You got to give me something here. So that day, I'm tying my shoes, and I don't know why, but this particular day, rather than tying my shoes right over left or left over right, I tied them the other way. I guess I just tied them a different way. And the laces to the shoes, the loops on the shoes fell left and right. Now, that doesn't sound like much to you, but to me, who had been tying shoes for 50 years, I was tying my shoes the same way my parents taught me to tie shoes. And my loops would always go north and south. And I hated that. I always liked people who had the laces that went, or the loops that went left and right. So I would take these and I would try and force solutions, and I would twist the laces like this. And of course they would come back this way, and I would twist them again. And I don't know how you do this. This day, you have to realize, nobody knows about this. My loops fall the other way. My higher power, I took this as a direct result of that threat that I gave my higher power, that you need to give me a sign. This was a sign. I will be there. I am there. No one knew of this. Only my higher power could have known. I then took step two and went on to step three. Step four was another matter entirely. It was an opportunity to escape, I thought. And so in step four, I asked my sponsor about it, and he said, well, you can do it any way you want. I use the AA's step, and you can do that. You can write an autobiography. You can, use past recovery, whatever you want to use. So I decided, all right, he did the four columns from AA. I'm going to do the four columns from AA. So I said, all right, now I'm going to make this look real good because it's my sponsor. So I didn't know how to use Excel spreadsheets. So I'm going to teach myself how to use Excel spreadsheets. So I start doing Excel spreadsheet, and I find out that I can make it. All right, I move the columns, make the columns. I could, make the rows and look pretty good. And so I come back the first week. He says, how are you doing? I said, oh, it's looking really good, And come back the second week. Well, second week, I found out that I could change the size of the lines, and I could change the column. It was really looking good. Now I could put a header on there. Asked him at the second week, how's it going? And he said, it's looking pretty good. Third week comes, and I learned how to do shading. This is starting to look good. And then the fourth week, I did fonts. Now we're 4 weeks into this, and I haven't typed a word yet, but it's looking really good. And so I figured I could get by with my sponsor on that. And he says, I don't know. So I went ahead and answered the questions, but the questions, it didn't get me anywhere. There's like three questions, anger, fear, and sex. Well, what? I mean, there's more to it than that. So I wound up doing the big book of Blueprint for Progress. And so I'm writing in that and doing everything. And so I get to the part on love and sex and all the good stuff. And in there, there's a question about infidelity. And so I had to decide, am I gonna do this? Right, I'm not on step eight, right? I don't need to do this, but in step four they've got this thing. So I decide, I pray on it, I decide, yes, I'm gonna try and be totally honest. So I write it down. And I came home and I threw my notebook on a chair. I had to go out to the store or something. When I came back, my wife had read my inventory. And she said, when were you going to tell me about that affair? It was 20 years ago. I had no intention, at least until I got to step eight, until I talked about it. I had no intention to tell her about this. But it had to happen, I guess. Higher power said, we're going to talk about this. You're not going to get around this. And so eventually we did, and we've had to deal with that. And it was, of course, the source of an amends that I had to do to my wife. In that, I was beginning with the courage to change. I was changing the way I was behaving. Rather than lying about my behavior, I was being accountable for it. That was different. I wasn't trying to be all things, all people. I was just trying to be me and accept whatever happens as a result of that. One other thing that happened as a result of these changes that I'm going through is my step 10 story, and some of you have heard it before. Sorry, I'm going to bore you with this one again, but I was flying down to Arizona every week to work, and I would fly back on Friday nights, and it was the summertime, and it was hotter than heck. Even inside in Arizona, it's hot in summer. But anyway, I'd figured out I used to fly Southwest, and back then Southwest was really just three rows, right? A, B, and C. And it was cattle call. And you got there first, you were first, you got there second, you were second. So I figured I'm going to be first because I want my seat. The seat I want is 11F. That's the seat I want. That's the seat you want. Or you could go with A and C, but F is the best. So F is the extra legroom. So I'm there first in line. Okay. So of course you got to stand now for an hour, right, before they load the plane. So I'm standing there for an hour, and for the first half hour, line A is filling up, and then line B comes, and in comes this guy, big old cowboy, a big old boy, cowboy hat, a rain slicker. It rains in Arizona in the summer, so he's got a rain slicker, not a raincoat. He's got the kind like Clint Eastwood wears, you know, with the big shoulders and everything. He's come strumming in, he's on his cell phone. And so he's talking at about this volume about this real estate deal he's got that's $25 million down, $125 million deal. Now we're going to make this happen, boys. And he goes on about this thing and on about this thing. And so we're waiting for another half hour, right, till that line fills up. And he is standing right next to me talking at this volume. I am practicing my program. I'm letting go and letting God. And that worked for 20 minutes, but the next 10 minutes, it got to be too much. So I didn't know what to do. I couldn't leave my place in line. I'd lose my seat. So I figured I'd just grin and bear it. So, So now we're loading the plane. I get in the plane, and I'm the first one out to get my seat. My deal is, in my seat, I get down, I sit down, I take a nap until the beverage cart comes out. Then I wake up and then I read my literature because I've got a meeting. This is a Friday night. I meet with my sponsor on Saturday. I got a meeting with my sponsor. I got to get something to say to him on Saturday. So I got to get something going here. So so I get down, I'm gonna take my nap. And pretty good. And then here comes Cowboy Bob down the aisle. He's still talking on his phone about the $125 million deal with $17 million down. Big Bob sits down right behind me, and he's still talking about his deal. So I'm thinking, this not going to work. This is, you know, I turn around, do I tell this guy to cut it down or whatever? But it's been a half hour out there. We're in here. Now the stewardess comes on, and she says, we're going to wait for the next plane to come. It's going to be about another 20 minutes. Well, Bob's still on his phone talking about the deal. Well, I'm getting fed up here, but I'm very passive aggressive. He's too big. I don't want to take him on. So I turn to the people next to me and I start making fun of him. And the people around me are hearing it because they're hearing all this deal. And I said, well, if he's such a big wheeler dealer, $125 million deal, $17 million down, how come he's flying Southwest? Tell me that. Well, I got a big reaction from everybody. And I got a reaction from Cowboy Bob, and he leans over and he said, you got a problem there, little fella? Well, I had gone past all my slogans, all the let go, let God. I turned around and said, bring it on, big boy, just bring it on. And I stood up, and the stewardess came over, and she said, boys, do we have a problem here? Because if we have a problem, I'm going to take you boys off the plane and suspend you from ever flying Southwest for the rest of your lives. I can do that. Boys, do we have a problem? I said, no, ma'am. I sat down. So my serenity is ruined, right? It's gone. So I pick up my literature. I still got to meet with my sponsor the next day and pick up my literature. And make a long story short, I find in my literature that I'm supposed to make amends to this guy. So I don't know how to do it. But I decide at the end, we get off the plane, and I waited for him. Off the plane, and he came out, and I held up my hand to him, and I said, I apologize. I really acted like a jerk in there, and I had no business making fun of you. And he wrapped his arm around me. I had said to him, I'm never going to see you again, but I'd like to make amends to you. What's your favorite charity? I'll make a contribution to your favorite charity. And he puts his arm around me and says, little fella, you're all right. You don't have to do that. We're fine. Now, that sounds like I grew. But I think that the only reason I did that was because I was going to see my sponsor the next day, and I couldn't tell him that I didn't make an apology to the guy. So I'm still working the program. Now, my wife has found sobriety. She works her program. She works her puzzle. I work mine. And things are well. But alcoholism is a family disease for us, and the family disease is active in our son. I've been living in Oregon for a few years, 42 years old. He's lost his wife. He has two estranged children. He goes up to Oregon to try and get some form of reconciliation with the two of them, but his good intentions are dashed by his drinking. He just can't control it. He's lost not only his marriage, the relationship with his sons, two girlfriends, several jobs, driver's license, car, friends. His relationship with us is very strained. And it's we worry about him constantly. I have a different way of approaching it than my wife does. He was, with his last girlfriend he lost, he texts mom, and they work out something. I come home from being out, and she says, pour yourself a drink. Make it a double. And she never does that. And she said, our son's going to come here, live with us. So she had made that decision herself, not in consultation with me. And so I had a lot of resentment. She said, not only that, but you're going to go up and get him. So I fought through that, and I decided I was going to go up to Oregon then the next morning. So we live in Vacaville, and Oregon is up 505 and 5, and it's 250 miles, and you just go. It's a gun barrel. So it's wintertime, so I'm going to leave that morning. I read up on some extra literature. I was pretty hot. So I'm leaving. I couldn't leave right away because the fog was really pretty bad. When we get into the valley here, it gets pretty bad. Tule fog, if you've ever seen it. Anyway, so I take off that morning, hotter than hell. And so I turn right onto Anger Avenue, right? Because I'm hotter than hell. And I drive on that until I get to the self-righteous overpass. And then that takes me to Interstate 505, what I've renamed Resentment Highway. Now, I've driven this road many, many times, and it's boring as hell, two-lane road. And it gives you a lot of time to think. And so I'm thinking that this ain't working. My serenity is gone. I call my sponsor. He's very kind. He listens to me. And then he tells me a story about how he had to go pick up his wife one time from jail. And when he called his sponsor to talk about that, his sponsor told him, you are not going to lecture her. You are not going to preach to her or ask her what she's doing or what the hell she thinks you're doing. You're going to love her. It's exactly what I needed to hear. I needed to figure out a way that I could change my attitude about that. Then, so it was pretty foggy out, but I noticed that after I talked with my sponsor, that fog of resentment was lifting a little bit. I did something I'd never done before. I called another Al-Anon person. Did you know, I didn't know this, did you know you can actually call two people in the same day with the same problem? I didn't know that. You could do that. I did that. And that was a very productive phone call. He had suggested I invite my higher power along for the ride. So I decided I'd do that. And I noticed that the fog was definitely lifting now. This fog of resentment was definitely lifting. I could see a little bit into the future. I could see that I needed to change my attitude. So I noticed that I left 505 and joined 5, if you know where that is. It's in the valley. You look like you're on the same road, but you make a change. And I was making a change from resentment, right, and taking on this new path to recovery, so to speak. I needed to make a pit stop, and I didn't know where I was, and it was patchy morning fog, and so I got off. And when I stopped to make the pit stop, I noticed I got back on the road. I was in self-pity city. That's where I had gone. I had gotten off Resentment Highway, but I'm in self-pity. I decided that it was not a pretty place. I would not want to live there. So I decided to get back on my road to recovery, and I got back on. I could see that there were other signs in the future that I could was going to come on. And so the next sign I saw was Regrets Road. And I thought to myself, well, regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. But then I realized that was Frank Sinatra on the radio. But I could also see that Regrets Road was a dead end. I did not want to go there. So I came back out, got back on Highway 5 and continued my trip up Sacramento Valley. And I came upon Tolerance Trails. Now, Tolerance Trail reminds me of what was often spoken by my sponsor. Can you accept them for who they are? My wife may make different decisions than mine. That does not make them wrong. It does not make me right. It doesn't change one thing. Just because I prefer an approach, it doesn't mean that's the right approach. I need not to catastrophize about disasters. I want control, right? When I get afraid, I hold on tighter. That's what I do. I control. It's a natural instinct. I need to kind of let that go. I need to understand that it's her son too. She gets to love him the way she wants to love him. I need to accept that about her, that she's not doing this to punish me. Further on down the road, I come to, of all things, Compassion Circle. Can you believe it? That's the next step on the train. What goes around comes around. My son suffers from the disease of alcoholism. He did not volunteer. If he suffered from another disease, would I hold that against him? No. I'd have compassion for his condition and try to find ways to love and support him. I am in no place to judge him. There but for the grace of God go I. Compassion Circle. I need to have compassion for this illness that he has and how it manifests itself and how it disrupts our family. Doesn't mean I have to like it. Didn't say that. But as I went further, I got back on my road to recovery, and I got out of the depression, and I started climbing Mount Shasta and Mount Ashland, what I've renamed Forgiveness Mountains. I needed to forgive myself for having the feelings that I did about this entire situation, about my wife and about my son. Feelings come and go. Feelings are not facts, right? You've told me this. The best way for me to get through them is to experience them, feel them. Don't deny them, feel them. They will not last forever. So having ascended the higher plateau, I get up to the Forgiveness Mountains, and before me lies Serenity Valley. And after the Forgiveness Mountains, the drive the rest of the way was pretty easy. I was able to hook up with our son, and we had a pleasant trip on our way back home to Vacaville. I found and committed myself to loving and supporting him in the healthiest way I know how. It would be great if the story ended there, but it didn't. The disease of alcohol is still active in him, and our son has reneged on the commitment not to drink in our house. The first time he did that, right, I'm thinking the alcoholic acts, and the Al-Anon reacts. My first reaction was that he needed to leave. You broke, you reneged the commitment, you're out. My wife didn't think so. She felt that he needed to stay. I'm thinking, you know, this is a boundary violation. You know, I don't want to be a doormat, right? I do not have to accept unacceptable behavior. And it tells me I don't have to make threats I don't intend to keep. Well, I intend to keep this one. This was a deal that we made. Hadn't I already backed up enough? I mean, I went and picked him up. I didn't agree with this whole approach. I thought it was the wrong way to go. Haven't I already given enough here? Well, we had set the boundary because his drinking made us feel unsafe, and he can be a very abusive drunk. So it wasn't going to change. My wife wasn't going to change her mind. I decided that I needed to have something to take care of Ken. So I decided that Ken was going to go on his own trip. He was going to go down to Arizona and visit with family down there. And my wife could stay, and she and my son could work out his length the rest of his stay. So he came home that night and rip-roaring drunk again. And he's very abusive of his mother, my wife. And I had to get in between them. I had to stop him. And I thought, I just can't go to Arizona. I mean, yeah, I think that was the way I was going to take care of me, but I can't do it. I would never forgive myself if something happened while he was here. You know, the daytimes are okay, the nighttimes are a little crazy. And I couldn't forgive myself if I had to do that. So we now have a schedule for him to go back to Oregon. It's going to happen next week. I don't know. Is it going to happen? It's supposed to happen Monday. I hope, and I told him, I hope you could find peace and happiness in Oregon. I think I have found a way to find what you promised me, that peace and even happiness, whether the alcohol or drinking or not. I found that way because I was able to work a program, because I was able to do the things you asked me to do, and because I stayed committed to those principles. I would not have been able to do that if I had not had these many years. I would have just reacted my old-fashioned way, taking control, and did it my way. You've changed the way I react. You've changed the way I live my life, and all for the better. I'm deeply grateful to you. I will absolutely keep coming back. I hope you do too. I need you. Thanks.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you so much for your share, for your experience, strength, and hope. Our hearts go out to you, and I'm sure things will develop the way they're supposed to. If we can have everybody unmuted.
Great talk, Ken.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you so much.
Great talk. Thank you so much.
Ken. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Your analogies. Love you.
Thank you, Ken.
Yeah. Hey. Hey, Ken.